A man can't tell nothing about them. I lived with the same one 15 years, and I'd be darned if I can. And I imagined a lot of things coming up between us, but I'd be darned if I ever thought it would be a body 4 days dead, and that a woman. But they make life hard on them, not taking it as it comes up, like a man does. So I laid there, hearing it commence to rain, thinking about them down there, squatting around the wagon and the rain on the roof, and thinking about Rachel crying there until after a while it was like I could still hear her crying even after she was asleep, and smelling it even when I knowed I couldn't. I couldn't decide even then whether I could or not, or if it wasn't just knowing it was what it was. So next morning I never went down there. I heard them hitching up, and then when I knowed they must be about ready to take out, I went out the front and went down the road toward the bridge until I heard the wagon come out of the lot and go back toward New Hope. And then when I come back to the house, Rachel jumped on me because I wasn't there to make them come in to breakfast. You can't tell about them. Just about when you decide they mean one thing, I'd be darned if you not only haven't got to change your mind, like as not you got to take a rawhiding for thinking they meant it. But it was still like I could smell it. And so I decided then that it wasn't smelling it, but it was just knowing it was there. Like you will get fooled now and then. But when I went to the barn, I knew different. When I walked into the hallway, I saw something. It kind of hunkered up when I come in, and I thought at first it was one of them got left. Then I saw what it was. It was a buzzard. It looked around me and saw me, and went on down the hall, spraddle-legged, with its wings kind of hunkered out, watching me first over one shoulder and then over the other, like a old, bald-headed man. When it got outdoors, it begun to fly. It had to fly a long time before it ever got up into the air, with it thick and heavy and full of rain like it was. If they was bent on going to Jefferson, I reckon they could have gone around up by Mount Vernon, like McCallum did. He'll get home about day after tomorrow, horseback. Then they'd be just 18 miles from town. But maybe this bridge being gone too has learned him the Lord's sense and judgment. That McCallum. He's been trading with me off and on for 12 years. I've known him from a boy up. Know his name as well as I do my own. But be darned if I can say it.
Dewey Dell. The signboard comes in sight. It is looking out at the road now, because it can wait. New Hope, 3 mi, it will say. New Hope, 3 mi. New Hope, 3 mi. And then the road will begin, curving away into the trees, empty with waiting, saying New Hope, 3 miles. I heard that my mother is dead. I wish I had time to let her die. I wish I had time to wish I had. It is because in the wild and outraged earth, too soon, too soon, too soon. It's not that I wouldn't and will not. It's that it is too soon, too soon, too soon. Now it begins to say it. New Hope, 3 miles. New Hope, 3 miles. That's what they mean by the womb of time, the agony and the despair of spreading bones, the hard girdle in which lie the outraged entrails of events. Cash's head turns slowly as we approach, his pale, empty, sad, composed, and questioning face following the red and empty curve. Beside the back wheel, Jewel sits on the horse, gazing straight ahead. The land runs out of Darl's eyes. They swim to pinpoints. They begin at my feet and rise along my body to my face. And then my dress is gone. I sit naked on the seat above the unhurrying mules, above the travail. Suppose I tell him to turn. He will do what I say. Don't you know he will do what I say? Once I waked with a black void rushing under me. I could not see. I saw Vardaman rise and go to the window and strike the knife into the fish, the blood gushing, hissing like steam, but I could not see. He'll do as I say. He always does. I can persuade him to anything. You know I can. Suppose I say, turn here. That was when I died that time. Suppose I do. We'll go to New Hope. We won't have to go to town. I rose and took the knife from the streaming fish, still hissing, and I killed Darl. When I used to sleep with Vardaman, I had a nightmare once. I thought I was awake, but I couldn't see and couldn't feel. I couldn't feel the bed under me, and I couldn't think what I was. I couldn't think of my name. I couldn't even think I am a girl. I couldn't even think I, nor even think I want to wake up, nor remember what was opposite to awake, so I could do that. I knew that something was passing, but I couldn't even think of time. Then all of a sudden, I knew that something was. It was wind blowing over me. It was like the wind came and blew me back from where it was. I was not, blowing the room, and Vardaman asleep, and all of them back under me again, and going on like a piece of cool silk dragging across my naked legs. It blows cool out of the pines, a sad, steady sound. New Hope. Was 3MI. Was 3MI. I believe in God. I believe in God. Why didn't we go to New Hope, Pa? Vardaman says. Mr. Sampson said we was, but we done passed the road. Darl says, look, Jewel. But he is not looking at me. He is looking at the sky. The buzzard is as still as if he were nailed to it. We turn into Tull's Lane. We pass the barn and go on, the wheels whispering in the mud, passing the green rows of cotton in the wild earth, and Vernon Little across the field behind the plow. He lifts his hand as we pass and stands there looking after us for a long while. Look, Jewel, Darl says. Jewel sits on his horse like they were both made out of wood, looking straight ahead. I believe in God. God. God, I believe in God.
Tull. After they passed, I had taken the mule out and looped up the trace chains and followed. They were sitting in the wagon at the end of the levee. Anse was sitting there, looking at the bridge where it was swagged down into the river with just the two ends in sight. He was looking at it like he had believed all the time that folks had been lying to him about it being gone, but like he was hoping all the time it really was. Kind of pleased astonishment he looked, sitting on the wagon in his Sunday pants, mumbling his mouth, looking like a uncurried horse dressed up. I don't know. The boy was watching the bridge where it was mid-sunk and logs and such drifted up over it. And it's swagging and shivering like the whole thing would go any minute. Big-eyed, he was watching it like he was to a circus. And the gal, too. When I come up, she looked around at me, her eyes kind of blaring up and going hard like I had made to touch her. Then she looked at Anse again, and then back at the water again. It was nigh up to the levee on both sides. The earth hid except for the tongue of it we was on going out to the bridge and then down into the water, and except for knowing how the road and the bridge used to look, a fellow couldn't tell where was the river and where the land. It was just a tangle of yellow, and the levee not less wider than a knife back, kind of, with us settin' in the wagon and on the horse and the mule. Dahl was looking at me, and then Cash turned and looked at me with that look in his eyes like when he was figuring on whether the planks would fit her that night, like he was measuring them inside of him and not asking you to say what you thought and not even letting on he was listening if you did say it, but listening all right. Jewel hadn't moved. He sat there on the horse, leaning a little forward, with that same look on his face when him and Dahl passed the house yesterday, coming back together. "If it was just up, we could drive across," Aunt says. "We could drive right on across it." Sometimes a log would get shoved over the jam and float on, rolling and turning, and we could watch it go on to where the ford used to be. It would slow up and whirl crossways and hang out of water for a minute, and you could tell by that that the ford used to be there. "But that don't show nothing," I say. "It could be a bar of quicksand built up there." We watch the log. Then the gal is looking at me again. "Mr. Whitfield crossed it," she says. "He was a horseback," I say. "And 3 days ago. It's riz 5 foot since." "If the bridge was just up," Aunt says. The log bobs up and goes on again. There's a lot of trash and foam, and you can hear the water. "But it's down," Aunt says. Cash says, "A careful fellow could walk across yonder on the planks and logs." "But you couldn't tote nothing," I say. "Likely time you set foot on that mess, it'll all go too. What do you think, Darl?" He is looking at me. He don't say nothing. Just looks at me with them queer eyes of his'n that makes folks talk. I always say it ain't never been what he done so much, or said, or anything so much, as how he looks at you. It's like he had got into the inside of you some way. Like somehow you was looking at yourself and your doings out in his eyes. Then I can feel that gal watching me like I had made to touch her. She says something to Aunts. "Mr. Whitfield," she says. "I give her my promised word in the presence of the Lord," Aunt says. "I reckon it ain't no need to worry." But still he does not start the mules. We sit there above the water. Another log bobs up over the jam and goes on. We watch it check up and swing slow for a minute where the ford used to be. Then it goes on. "It might start falling tonight," I say. "You could lay over one more day." Then Jewel turns sideways on the horse. He's not moved until then, and he turns and looks at me. His face is kind of green, then it would go red and then green again. "Get to hell on back to your damn plowing," he says. "Who the hell asked you to follow us here?" "I never meant no harm," I say. "Shut up, Jewel," Cash says. Jewel looks back at the water, his face gritted, going red and green and then red. "Well," Cash says after a while, "what you want to do?" Ants don't say nothing. He sits humped up, mumbling his mouth. "If it was just up, we could drive across it," he says. "Come on," Jewel says, moving the horse. "Wait," Cash says. He looks at the bridge. We look at him, except Ants and the gal. They are looking at the water. "Dewey Dell and Vardman and Pa better walk across on the bridge," Cash says. "Vernon can help them," Jewel says. "And we can hitch his mule ahead of ourn." "You ain't going to take my mule into that water," I say. Jewel looks at me. His eyes look like pieces of a broken plate. I'll pay for your damn mule. I'll buy it from you right now. My mule ain't going into that water, I say. Jewel's going to use his horse, Darl says. Why won't you risk your mule, Vernon? Shut up, Darl, Cash says. You and Jewel both. My mule ain't going into that water, I say.
Darl. He sits the horse, glaring at Vernon, his lean face suffused up to and beyond the pale rigidity of his eyes. The summer when he was 15, he took a spell of sleeping. One morning, when I went to feed the mules, the cows were still in the tie-up, and then I heard Pa go back to the house and call him. When we came on back to the house for breakfast, he passed us, carrying the milk buckets, stumbling along like he was drunk, and he was milking when we put the mules in and went on to the field without him. We had been there an hour, and still he never showed up. When Dewey Dell came with our lunch, Pa sent her back to find Jewel. They found him in the tie-up, sitting on the stool, asleep. After that, every morning Pa would go in and wake him. He would go to sleep at the supper table, and soon as supper was finished, he would go to bed. And when I came into bed, he would be lying there like a dead man. Yet still, Pa would have to wake him in the morning. He would get up, but he wouldn't hardly have half sense. He would stand for Pa's jawing and complaining without a word, and take the milk buckets and go to the barn, and once I found him asleep at the cow, the bucket in place and half full, and his hands up to the wrists in the milk, and his head against the cow's flank. After that, Dewey Dell had to do the milking. He still got up when Pa waked him, going about what we told him to do in that dazed way. It was like he was trying hard to do them, that he was as puzzled as anyone else. "Are you sick?" Ma said. "Don't you feel all right?" "Yes," Jewel said. "I feel all right." "He's just lazy, trying me," Pa said. And Jewel, standing there, asleep on his feet like as not. "Ain't you?" he said, waking Jewel up again to answer. "No," Jewel said. "You take off and stay in the house today," Ma said. "With that whole bottom piece to be busted out?" Pa said. "If you ain't sick, what's the matter with you?" "Nothing," Jewel said. "I'm all right." "All right?" Pa said. "You're asleep on your feet this minute." "No," Jewel said. "I'm all right." "I want him to stay at home today," Ma said.
"I'll need him," Pa said. "It's tight enough with all of us to do it."
"You'll just have to do the best you can with Cash and Darl," Ma said. "I want him to stay in today." But he wouldn't do it.
"I'm all right," he said, going on.
But he wasn't all right. Anybody could see it. He was losing flesh, and I have seen him go to sleep chopping, watched the hoe going slower and slower up and down, with less and less of an arc, until it stopped, and he leaning on it, motionless in the hot shimmer of the sun. Ma wanted to get the doctor, but Pa didn't want to spend the money without it was needful. And Jewel did seem all right, except for his thinness and his way of dropping off to sleep at any moment. He ate hearty enough, except for his way of going to sleep in his plate, with a piece of bread halfway to his mouth and his jaws still chewing. But he swore he was all right. It was Ma that got Dewey Dell to do his milking, paid her somehow, and the other jobs around the house that Jewel had been doing before supper, she found some way for Dewey Dell and Vardaman to do them, and doing them herself when Pa wasn't there. She would fix him special things to eat and hide them for him. And that may have been when I first found it out, that Addie Bundren should be hiding anything she did, who had tried to teach us that deceit was such that, in a world where it was, nothing else could be very bad or very important,
not even poverty. And at times, when I went in to go to bed, she would be sitting in the dark by Jewel, where he was asleep. And I knew that she was hating herself for that deceit, and hating Jewel because she had to love him so, that she had to act the deceit. One night, she was taken sick, and when I went to the barn to put the team in and drive to Tull's, I couldn't find the lantern. I remembered noticing it on the nail the night before, but it wasn't there now at midnight. So I hitched in the dark and went on and came back with Mrs. Tull just after daylight. And there the lantern was, hanging on the nail where I remembered it and couldn't find it before. And then one morning while Dewey Dell was milking just before sunup, Jewel came into the barn from the back, through the hole in the back wall, with the lantern in his hand. I told Cash, and Cash and I looked at one another.
"Rutting," Cash said.
"Yes," I said, "but why the lantern? And every night, too. No wonder he's losing flesh. Are you going to say anything to him?"
"Won't do any good," Cash said.
"What he's doing now won't do any good either."
"I know, but he'll have to learn that himself. Give him time to realize that it'll save, that there'll be just as much more tomorrow, and he'll be all right. I wouldn't tell anybody, I reckon."
"No," I said. "I told Dewey Dell not to. Not Ma, anyway."
"No, not Ma."
After that, I thought it was right comical. He acting so bewildered and willing and dead for sleep and gaunt as a beanpole and thinking he was so smart with it. And I wondered who the girl was. I thought of all I knew that it might be, but I couldn't say for sure.
"'Tain't any girl," Cash said. "It's a married woman somewhere. Ain't any young girl got that much daring and staying power. That's what I don't like about it."
"Why?" I said. "She'll be safer for him than a girl would. More judgment." He looked at me, his eyes fumbling, the words fumbling at what he was trying to say.
"It ain't always the safe things in this world that a fella..."
"You mean the safe things are not always the best things?"
"I'm best," he said, fumbling again. "It ain't the best things, the things that are good for him, a young boy. A fella kind of hates to see wallowing in somebody else's mire."
That's what he was trying to say. When something is new and hard and bright, there ought to be something a little better for it than just being safe, since the safe things are just the things that folks have been doing so long they have worn the edges off, and there's nothing to the doing of them that leaves a man to say, "That was not done before, and it cannot be done again." So we didn't tell, not even when after a while he'd appear suddenly in the field beside us and go to work, without having had time to get home and make out he had been in bed all night. He would tell Ma that he hadn't been hungry at breakfast, or that he had eaten a piece of bread while he was hitching up the team. But Cash and I knew that he hadn't been home at all on those nights, and he had come up out of the woods when we got to the field. But we didn't tell. Summer was almost over then. We knew that when the nights began to cool, she would be done, if he wasn't. But when fall came and the nights began to get longer, the only difference was that he would always be in bed for Pa to wake him, getting him up at last in that first state of semi-idiocy like when it first started, worse than when he had stayed out all night.
"She's sure a stayer," I told Cash. "I used to admire her, but I downright respect her now."
"It ain't a woman," he said.
"You know," I said,
but he was watching me.
"What is it, then?"
"That's what I aim to find out," he said.
"You can trail him through the woods all night if you want to," I said. "I'm not."
"I ain't trailing him," he said.
"What do you call it, then?"
"I ain't trailing him," he said. "I don't mean it that way." And so a few nights later, I heard Jewel get up and climb out the window, and then I heard Cash get up and follow him. The next morning, when I went to the barn,
Cash was already there. The mules fed, and he was helping Dewey Dell milk. And when I saw him, I knew that he knew what it was. Now and then I would catch him watching Jewel with a queer look, like having found out where Jewel went and what he was doing had given him something to really think about at last. But it was not a worried look. It was the kind of look I would see on him when I would find him doing some of Jewel's work around the house, work that Pa still thought Jewel was doing and that Ma thought Dewey Dell was doing. So I said nothing to him, believing that when he got done digesting it in his mind, he would tell me. But he never did. One morning, it was November then, 5 months since it started, Jewel was not in bed, and he didn't join us in the field. That was the first time Ma learned anything about what had been going on.
End of Disc 3.
That was the first time Ma learned anything about what had been going on. She sent Vardaman down to find where Jewel was, and after a while she came down too. It was as though, so long as the deceit ran along quiet and monotonous, all of us let ourselves be deceived, abetting it unawares, or maybe through cowardice, since all people are cowards and naturally prefer any kind of treachery because it has a bland outside. But now, it was like we had all, and by a kind of telepathic agreement of admitted fear, flung the whole thing back like covers on the bed, and we all sitting bolt upright in our nakedness, staring at one another and saying, "Now is the truth. He hasn't come home. Something has happened to him. We let something happen to him." Then we saw him. He came up along the ditch and then turned straight across the field, riding the horse. Its mane and tail were going, as though in motion they were carrying out the splotchy pattern of its coat. He looked like he was riding on a big pinwheel, barebacked, with a rope bridle, and no hat on his head. It was a descendant of those Texas ponies Flem Snopes brought here 25 years ago and auctioned off for $2 a head, and nobody but old Lon Quick ever caught his and still owned some of the blood because he could never give it away. He galloped up and stopped, his heels in the horse's ribs and it dancing and swirling like the shape of its mane and tail and the splotches of its coat had nothing whatever to do with the flesh and bone horse inside him. And he sat there, looking at us.
"Where did you get that horse?"
Pa said.
"Bought it,"
Jewel said, "from Mr. Quick."
"Bought it?" Pa said. "With what? Did you buy that thing on my word?"
"It was my money," Jewel said. "I earned it. You won't need to worry about it."
"Jewel," Ma said. "Jewel."
"It's all right," Cash said. "He earned the money. He cleaned up that 40 acres of new ground Quick laid out last spring. He did it single-handed, working at night by lantern. I saw him. So I don't reckon that horse cost anybody anything except Jewel. I don't reckon we need worry."
"Jewel," Ma said. "Jewel."
Then she said,
"You come right to the house and go to bed."
"Not yet," Jewel said. "I ain't got time. I gotta get me a saddle and bridle. Mr. Quick says he..."
"Jewel,"
Ma said, looking at him.
I'll give...
Then she began to cry. She cried hard, not hiding her face, standing there in her faded wrapper, looking at him, and him on the horse, looking down at her, his face growing cold and a little sick-looking, until he looked away Quick, and Cash came and touched her. "You go on to the house," Cash said. "This here ground is too wet for you. You go on now." She put her hands to her face then, and after a while she went on, stumbling a little on the plow marks. But pretty soon she straightened up and went on. She didn't look back. When she reached the ditch, she stopped and called Vardaman. He was looking at the horse,
kind of dancing up and down by it.
"Let me ride, Jewel," he said. "Let me ride, Jewel."
Jewel looked at him. Then he looked away again, holding the horse reined back. Pa watched him, mumbling his lip.
"So, you bought a horse," he said. "You went behind my back and bought a horse. You never consulted me. You know how tight it is for us to make by. Yet you bought a horse for me to feed. Taken the work from your flesh and blood and bought a horse with it."
Jewel looked at Pa, his eyes paler than ever.
"He won't never eat a mouthful of yours," he said. "Not a mouthful. I'll kill him first. Don't you never think it. Don't you never."
"Let me ride, Jewel," Vardaman said. "Let me ride, Jewel."
He sounded like a cricket in the grass, a little one.
"Let me ride, Jewel."
That night, I found Ma sitting beside the bed where he was sleeping, in the dark. She cried hard, maybe because she had to cry so quiet. Maybe because she felt the same way about tears she did about deceit, hating herself for doing it, hating him because she had to. And then I knew that I knew. I knew that as plain on that day as I knew about Dewey Dell on that day.
Tull. So they finally got Anse to say what he wanted to do, and him and the gal and the boy got out of the wagon. But even when we were on the bridge, Anse kept on looking back, like he thought maybe once he was out in the wagon, the whole thing would kind of blow up, and he would find himself back yonder in the field again, and her laying up there in the house, waiting to die, and it to do all over again. "You ought to let them take in your mule," he says. And the bridge shaking and swaying under us, going down into the moiling water like it went clean through to the other side of the earth. And the other end, coming up out in the water like it wasn't the same bridge at all. And that them that would walk up out in the water on that side must come from the bottom of the earth. But it was still whole. You could tell that by the way when this end swagged. It didn't look like the other end swagged at all. Just like the other trees in the bank yonder were swinging back and forth slow like on a big clock. And them logs scraping and bumping at the sunk part and tilting end up and shooting clean out in the water and tumbling on toward the ford and the waiting, slick, whirling and foamy. "What good would that have done?" I says. "If your team can't find the ford and haul it across, what good would 3 mules or even 10 mules do?" "I ain't asking it of you," he says. "I can always do for me and mine. I ain't asking you to risk your mule. But ain't your dead. I am not blaming you." "They oughta went back and laid over until tomorrow," I says. The water was cold. It was thick like slush ice, only it kind of lived. One part of you knowed it was just water, the same thing that had been running under the same bridge for a long time. Yet when them logs would come spewing up out in it, you were not surprised, like they was a part of water, of the waiting and the threat. It was like when we was across, up out of the water again and the hard earth under us, that I was surprised. It was like we hadn't expected the bridge to end on the other bank, on something tame like the hard earth again that we had tromped on before this time and knowed well. Like it couldn't be me here, because I'd have had better sense than to done what I just done. And when I looked back and saw the other bank and saw my mule standing there where I used to be, and knew that I'd have to get back there some way, I knew it couldn't be, because I just couldn't think of anything that could make me cross that bridge ever even once. Yet here I was, and the fellow that could make himself cross it twice couldn't be me, not even if Cora told him to. It was that boy. I said, Here, you better take a hold of my hand. And he waited and held to me. I'd be darned if it wasn't like he'd come back and got me. Like he was saying, they won't nothing hurt you. Like he was saying about a fine place he knowed where Christmas come twice with Thanksgiving and lasts on through the winter and the spring and the summer, and if I just stayed with him, I'd be all right too. When I looked back at my mule, it was like he was one of these here spyglasses, and I could look at him standing there and see all the broad land and my house sweated out in it like it was the more the sweat, the broader the land. The more the sweat, the tighter the house, because it would take a tight house for Cora, to hold Cora like a jar of milk in the spring. You've got to have a tight jar, or you'll need a powerful spring. So if you have a big spring, why then you have the incentive to have tight, well-made jars, because it is your milk, sour or not, because you would rather have milk that will sour than to have milk that won't, because you are a man. And him holding to my hand, his hand that hot and confident, so that I was like to say, look a-here, can't you see that mule yonder? He never had no business over here, so he never come, not being nothing but a mule. Because a fella can see ever now and then that children have more sense than him. But he don't like to admit it to them until they have beards. After they have a beard, they are too busy because they don't know if they'll ever quite make it back to where they were in sense before they was haired. So you don't mind admitting then to folks that are worrying about the same thing that ain't worth the worry that you are yourself. Then we was over, and we stood there, looking at Cash turning the wagon around. We watched them drive back down the road to where the trail turned off into the bottom. After a while, the wagon was out of sight. We better get on down to the fort and get ready to help, I said. I give her my word, Aunt says. It is sacred on me. I know you begrudge it, but she will bless you in heaven. Well, they got to finish circumventing the land before they can dare the water, I said. Come on. It's the turning back, he said. It ain't no luck in turning back. He was standing there, humped, mournful, looking at the empty road beyond the swaggin' and swaying bridge. And that gal, too, with the lunch basket on one arm and that package under the other. Just going to town. Bent on it. They would risk the fire and the earth and the water and all just to eat a sack of bananas. You ought to laid over a day, I said. It would have fell some by morning. It mought not have rained tonight, and it can't get no higher. I give my promise, he says. She is counting on it.
Darl. Before us the thick, dark current runs. It talks up to us in a murmur, becomes ceaseless and myriad. The yellow surface dimpled monstrously into fading swirls, traveling along the surface for an instant, silent, impermanent, and profoundly significant, as though just beneath the surface, something huge and alive waked for a moment of lazy alertness out of and into light slumber again. It clucks and murmurs among the spokes and about the mule's knees, yellow, scummed with flotsam and with thick soiled gouts of foam, as though it had sweat, lathering like a driven horse. Through the undergrowth it goes with a plaintive sound, a musing sound. In it, the unwinded cane and saplings lean as before a little gale, swaying without reflections, as though suspended on invisible wires from the branches overhead. Above the ceaseless surface they stand, trees, cane, vines, rootless, severed from the earth, spectral above a scene of immense yet circumscribed desolation, filled with the voice of the waste and mournful water. Cash and I sit in the wagon. Jules sits the horse at the off-rear wheel. The horse is trembling, its eye rolling wild and baby blue in its long pink face, its breathing stertorous like groaning. He sits erect, poised, looking quietly and steadily and quickly this way and that, his face calm, a little pale, alert. Cash's face is also gravely composed. He and I look at one another with long, probing looks, looks that plunge unimpeded through one another's eyes and into the ultimate secret place where for an instant Cash and Darl crouch flagrant and unabashed in all the old terror and the old foreboding, alert and secret and without shame. When we speak, our voices are quiet, detached. I reckon we're still in the road, all right. Tull taken and cut them two big white oaks. I heard tell how at high water, in the old days, they used to line up the ford by them trees. I reckon he did that 2 years ago when he was logging down here. I reckon he never thought that anybody would ever use this ford again. I reckon not. Yes, it must have been then. He cut a side of timber out in here then. Paid off that mortgage with it, I hear tell. Yes. Yes, I reckon so. I reckon Vernon could have done that.
That's a fact. Most folks that logs in this here country, they need a darn good farm to support the sawmill, or maybe a store. But I reckon Vernon could.
I reckon so. He's a sight.
Aye, Vernon is. Yes, it must still be here. He never would have got that timber out of here if he hadn't cleaned out that old road. I reckon we are still on it.
He looks about quietly, at the position of the trees, leaning this way and that, looking back along the floorless road shaped vaguely high in air by the position of the lopped and felled trees, as if the road, too, had been soaked free of earth and floated upward, to leave in its spectral tracing a monument to a still more profound desolation than this above which we now sit, talking quietly of old security and old, trivial things. Jewel looks at him, then at me. Then his face turns in that quiet, constant questing about the scene, the horse trembling quietly and steadily between his knees.
He could go on ahead slow and sort of feel it out, I say.
Yes, Cash says, not looking at me. His face is in profile as he looks forward where Jewel has moved on ahead.
He can't miss the river, I say. He couldn't miss seeing it 50 yards ahead.
Cash does not look at me, his face in profile.
If I'd just suspicioned it, I could have come down last week and taken a sight on it.
The bridge was up then, I say.
He does not look at me.
Whitfield crossed it a horseback.
Jewel looks at us again, his expression sober and alert and subdued. His voice is quiet.
What do you want me to do?
I ought to come down last week and taken a sight on it, Cash says.
We couldn't have known, I say. There wasn't any way for us to know.
I'll ride on ahead, Jewel says. You can follow where I am.
He lifts the horse. It shrinks, bowed. He leans to it, speaking to it, lifting it forward almost bodily. It setting its feet down with gingerly splashings, trembling, breathing harshly. He speaks to it, murmurs to it.
Go on, he says. I ain't gonna let nothing hurt you. Go on now.
Jewel,
Cash says. Jewel does not look back. He lifts the horse on.
He can swim, I say. If he'll just give the horse time, anyhow.
When he was born, he had a bad time of it. Ma would sit in the lamplight, holding him on a pillow on her lap. We would wake and find her so. There would be no sound from them. That pillow was longer than him, Cash says. He is leaning a little forward. I ought to come down last week and sighted it. I ought to done it. That's right, I say. Neither his feet nor his head would reach the end of it. You couldn't have known, I say. I ought to done it, he says. He lifts the reins. The mules move into the traces. The wheels murmur alive in the water. He looks back and down at Addie. It ain't on a balance, he says. At last, the trees open. Against the open river, Jewel sits the horse, half-turned, it belly-deep now. Across the river, we can see Vernon and Pa and Vardaman and Dewey Dell. Vernon is waving at us, waving us further downstream. We are too high up, Cash says. Vernon is shouting too, but we cannot make out what he says for the noise of the water. It runs steady and deep now, unbroken, without sense of motion until a log comes along, turning slowly. Watch it, Cash says. We watch it and see it falter and hang for a moment, the current building up behind it in a thick wave, submerging it for an instant before it shoots up and tumbles on. There it is, I say. Aye, Cash says. It's there. We look at Vernon again. He is now flapping his arms up and down. We move on downstream, slowly and carefully, watching Vernon. He drops his hands. This is the place, Cash says.
Well, goddammit, let's get across then, Jewel says.
He moves the horse on. You wait, Cash says. Jewel stops again.
Well, by God, he says.
Cash looks at the water. Then he looks back at Addie. It ain't on a balance, he says.
Then go on back to the goddamn bridge and walk across, Jewel says. You and Darl both. Let me on that wagon.
Cash does not pay him any attention. It ain't on a balance, he says.
Yes, sir. We got to watch it.
Watch it, hell, Jewel says.
You get out of that wagon and let me have it. By God, if you're afraid to drive it over...
His eyes are pale as two bleached chips in his face.